In response to respectful but pointed requests to keep the responses on some sort of factual track and spare them all the egg-headed abstractions, Madame Psychosis's deforming trauma in its combination of coincidence and malefic intention had been like something right out of the auteur's most ghastly and unresolvable proto-incestuous disaster films. For example, The Night Wears a Sombrero, Dial C for Concupiscence, and The Unfortunate Case of Me. That, Madame Psychosis, an only child, had been extremely and heartwarmingly close to her father, a low-pH chemist for a Kentucky reagent outfit, who'd apparently had an extremely close only child and watching movies together-based relationship with his own mother, and seemed to reenact the closeness with Madame Psychosis, taking her to movies on a nearly daily basis in Kentucky, and driving her all over the Mid-South for various junior baton-twirling competitions, while his wife, Madame Psychosis's mother, a devoutly religious but wounded and neurasthenic woman with a fear of public spaces, stayed home on the family farm, canning preserves and seeing to the administration of the farm, etc. But that things had gotten first strange and then creepy as Madame Psychosis entered puberty, apparently. Specifically, the low pH father had gotten creepy, seeming to behave as if Madame Psychosis were getting younger instead of older, taking her to increasingly child-rated films at the local Cineplex, refusing to acknowledge issues of menses or breasts, strongly discouraging dating, etc. Apparently, issues were complicated by the fact that Madame Psychosis emerged from puberty as an almost freakishly beautiful young woman, especially in a part of the United States where poor nutrition and indifference to dentition and hygiene made physical beauty an extremely rare and sort of discomforting condition, one in no way shared by Madame Psychosis's toothless and fireplug-shaped mother, who said not a word as Madame Psychosis's father interdicted everything from brassieres to pap smears. Addressing the nubile Madame Psychosis in progressively puerile baby talk, and continuing to use her childhood diminutive like Pookie or Putty, as he attempted to dissuade her from accepting a scholarship to a Boston university whose film and film cartridge studies program was, he apparently maintained, full of, quote, nasty pootum wookie bam-bams, unquote, whatever family code pejorative this signified. That, to cut to a chase which the interviewer's hands-on-hip attitudes and replacement of the lamp's bulb with a much higher wattage signified they'd very much like to see cut to, as is often the case, it wasn't until Madame Psychosis got to college and gradually acquired some psychic distance and matter for emotional comparison that she even began to see how creepy her reagent daddy's regression had been. And not until a certain major sports star's son's autograph on a punctured football inspired more emailed suspicion and sarcasm than gratitude from home in Kentucky, that she began even to suspect that her lack of social life throughout puberty might have had as much to do with her daddy's intrusive discouragement as with her actianizing pubescent charms. That, pausing briefly to spell actianizing, the shit had hit the intergenerational psychic fan when Madame Psychosis brought the auteur's little rotter of a son home to the Kentucky spread for the third time for Thanksgiving in the year of the Tuck's medicated pad, and witnessing her daddy's infantilizing conduct of her and her mother's wordless compulsive canning and cooking, not to mention the terrific tension that resulted when Madame Psychosis attempted to move some of the stuffed animals out of her room to make room for the auteur's son, in short experiencing her home and daddy through the comparative filter of enmeshment with the auteur's son, brought Madame Psychosis to the crisis that precipitates speaking the unspeakable. And that it had been at Thanksgiving dinner, at midday on the 24th of November, YTMP, when the low-pH daddy began not only cutting up Madame Psychosis's plate's turkey for her, but mashing it into puree between the tines of his fork, all under the raised comparative eyebrows of the auteur's son, that Madame Psychosis finally aired the unspoken question of why. With her now of legal age and living with a male, and retired from childhood's twirling and carving out an adult career on one and potentially two sides of the film camera, did her own personal daddy seem to feel that she needed help to chew? Molly Notkin's secondhand take on the emotional eruptions that ensued is not detailed, but she feels she can state with confidence that it's plausibly a case of any kind of system that's been under enormous silent pressure for some time. That when the system finally blows, the accreted pressure's such that it's almost always a full-scale eruption. The low pH daddy's enormous stress had apparently erupted right there at the table, with his grown daughter's white meat between his tines, in the confession that he'd been secretly, silently, in love with Madame Psychosis from way, way back. That the love had been the real thing, pure, unspoken, genuflectory, timeless, impossible. That he never touched her, wouldn't, nor ogle, less out of a horror of being the sort of Mid-South father who touched and ogled, than out of the purity of his doomed love for the little girl he'd escorted to the movies as proudly as any beau, daily. That the repression and disguisability of his pure love hadn't been all that hard when Madame Psychosis had been juvenile and sexless, but at the onset of puberty and nubility the pressure had become so great that he could compensate only by regressing the child mentally to an age of incontinence and pre-mashed meat, and that his awareness of how creepy his denial of her maturation must have seemed, even though neither the daughter nor mother, even now wordlessly chewing a candied yam, had remarked on it, the denial and creepiness, although the man's beloved pointers were given to whimper and scratch at the door when the denial had gotten especially creepy, animals being way more sensitive than humans to emotional anomalies, in Molly Notkin's experience, had raised his internal limbic system's pressure to near intolerable foot-kilo levels, and that he'd been hanging on for dear life for the past, nigh on now, a decade. But that now that he'd had to actually stand witness to the removal of Pookie and Urgelbear and others from her ballerina-wallpapered room, to make space for a non-related mature male whose physical vigor through the peephole the daddy'd exerted every gram of trembling will he'd possessed, trying not to drill the hole in the bathroom wall just above the mirror, over the sink, whose pipes made the wall behind the headboard of Madame Psychosis's room's bed sing and clunk, and through which, late at night, claiming to mother a case of skitters from all the holiday nibbles, hunched atop the sink, every night since Madame Psychosis and the auteur's son had first arrived to sleep together in the unstuffed, animaled bed of a childhood, through which he'd been all but tortured by the purity of his impossible love for the... That it had been at this point that Madame Psychosis's mother's fork and then whole plate had clattered to the floor, and that, amid the sounds of the pointers under the table fighting over that plate, the mother's own denial system's pressure blew, and she freaked, announcing publicly at the table that she and the daddy had not once known each other as man and wife since Madame Psychosis had first menstruated, that she'd known something incredibly creepy was going on but had denied it, evacuated her suspicions, and placed them under great pressure in the bell jar of her own denial because, she admits, is probably less accurate than something like keens or shrieks or jabbers, that her own father, an itinerant camp-meeting preacher, had molested her and her sister all through childhood, ogled and touched and worse, and that this had been why she'd married at just 16, to escape, and that now it was clear to her that she'd married the exact same kind of monster, the kind who spurns his ordained mate and wants his daughter. She'd said maybe it was her, she, the mother, who was the monster, which, if so, she was tired of hiding it and appearing falsely before God and man. Whereupon she'd reeled from her place and hurtled three pointers and run down to the daddy's acid lab in the cellar to disfigure herself with acid. That the daddy'd kept a world-class collection of various acids in Pyrex brand flasks on wooden shelves down in the cellar. That the daddy, the rotter of a son, and finally a shock slowed Madame Psychosis, had all run down the stairs after the mother and hit the cellar just as the mother had removed the stopper of a Pyrex flask with an enormous, half-eaten-away skull on the side, which along with the flaming scarlet piece of litmus paper afloat inside signified an incredibly low pH and corrosive type of acid. That Madame Psychosis's name was, in reality, Lucille Duquette, and the daddy's name, either Earl or Al Duquette, of extreme southeast Kentucky, way down near Tennessee and Virginia. That, despite the little rotter's professions of self-recrimination for allowing the deformity to take place, and claim that the swirling systems of guilt and horror and denial-informed forgiveness made a committed relationship with Madame Psychosis increasingly untenable, it didn't take an expert in character disorders and weaknesses to figure out why the fellow had given Madame Psychosis the boot within months of the traumatic deformity, now did it. That right on the hysterical cusp, where internalized rage can so easily shift to externalized rage, the mother had hurled the low pH flask at the daddy, who'd reflexively ducked. And that the rotter, one Orin, right behind, a former tennis champion with superb upper body reflexes, had instinctively ducked also, leaving Madame Psychosis, dazed and bradykinetic from the sudden venting of so many high-pressure repressive family systems, open for a direct facial hit, resulting in the traumatic deformity. And that it had been everyone's failure to press any charges that had liberated the mother from Southeast Kentucky custody and allowed her access once again to her home's kitchen, where, apparently despondent, she committed suicide by putting her extremities down the garbage disposal. First one arm and then, kind of miraculously if you think about it, the other arm.
332.
The most distant and obscure Tuesday p.m. meeting listed in the little white Metro Boston Recovery Options booklet.
333.
The incisorless, nostril-pierced girl down at the Innett House had given him looked to be a males-only thing at 1730 hours, out in Natick, almost in Framingham, at something with a location on Route 27 that the MBRO booklet listed only as QRS-32A. Hal, who had no last class period, rushed through PMs, dispatching Shaw 1 and 3 by the time the regular PMs were even warming up, then skipping left-leg circuits in the weight room, and was also foregoing tonight's lemon chicken with potato rolls, all to blast out to Natick in time to check this anti-substance fellowship meeting business out. He wasn't sure why, since it didn't seem to be any kind of slobbering inability to abstain that was the problem. He hadn't had so much as a milligram of a substance, of any kind, since the 30-day urological condemnation of last week. The issues, the horrific way his head's felt, increasingly, since he abruptly abandoned all hope.
334.
It wasn't just nightmares and saliva. It was as if his head perched on the bedpost all night now. And in the terribly early a.m. when Hal's eyes snapped open immediately said, "Glad you're up. I've been wanting to talk to you." And then didn't let up all day. Having at him like a well-revved chainsaw all day until he could finally try to fall unconscious, crawling into the rack, wretched, to await more bad dreams. 24/7s of feeling wretched and bereft. Dusk was coming earlier. Hal signed out at the portcullis and blasted down the hill and took the tow truck up Commonwealth Avenue to the CC Reservoir and then south on Hammond, the same deadening route as the ETA conditioning run, except when he hit Boylston Street, he turned right and struck out west. Once it cleared West Newton, Boylston Street became Shunpike Route 9, the major west suburb commuter alternative to the suicidal I-90, and 9 suburb-hopped serpentine all the way west to Natick and Route 27. Hal crawled through traffic on a major flow road that had once been a cowpath. By the time he was in Wellesley Hills, the sky's combustion-ish orange had deepened to the hellish crimson of a fire's last embers. Darkness fell with a clunk shortly after, and Hal's spirits with it. He felt pathetic and absurd, even going to check this Narcotics Anonymous meeting thing out. Everybody always flashed his or her brights at the tow truck because the headlamps were set so senselessly high on the truck's grill. The little portable disc player had been detached by either Pemulus or Axford and not returned. WYYY was a ghostly thread of jazz against a sea of static. AM had only corporate rock and reports that the General Administration had scheduled and then canceled a special spontaneous disseminated address to the nation on subjects unknown. NPR had a kind of roundtable on potential subjects, George Will's laryngectomy prosthesis sounded hideous. Hal preferred silence and traffic sounds. He ate two of three $4 brand muffins he'd whipped in for at a Cleveland Circle gourmet bakery, grimacing as he swallowed because he'd forgotten a tonic to wash them down. And then put in a mammoth plug of Kodiak and spat periodically into his special NASA glass, which fit neatly into the cup holder down by the transmission, and passed the last 15 minutes of the dull drive, considering the probable etymological career of the word anonymous. All the way, he supposed, from the Aeolic Ovia, through Tyne's B.S. 1580s reference to Anonymal Chronicles, and whether it was joined way back somewhere at the Saxonic taproot to the Old English On Ane, which supposedly meant all as one or as one body, and became Cynewulf's eventual standard inversion to the classic Anon, maybe. Then called up on his mnemonic screen the developmental history since B.S. 35 of the initial substance group AA, on which there'd been such a lengthy entry in the discursive OED that Hal hadn't had to hit any sort of outside database to feel more or less factually prepared to drop into its spin-off NA, and at least give the thing an appraising once-over. Hal can summon a kind of mental Xerox of anything he'd ever read and basically read it all over again, at will, which talent the abandonment of hope hasn't, so far, compromised, the withdrawal's effects being more like emotional/salivo-digestive. The rock faces on either side of the truck when 27 goes through blasted hills of rock. The very fringes of the Berkshire's penumbra are either granite or gneiss. Hal, for a while, also practices saying, "My name's Mike." "Mike, hi." "Hey there, name's Mike," etc., into the truck's rear view. By 15 minutes east of Natick, it becomes obvious that the little booklet's terse QRS designates a facility called Quabbin Recovery Systems, which is easy to find. Roadside ad signs starting to announce the place several clicks away, each sign a little different and designed to form a little like narrative of which actual arrival at QRS would be the climax. Even Hal's late father was too young really to remember Burma Shave signs. Quabbin Recovery Systems is set far back from Route 27 on a winding, groomed gravel road, flanked all the way up by classy old-time standing lanterns, whose glass shades are pebbled and faceted like candy dishes, and seem more for mood than illumination. Then the actual building's driveways, an even more winding little road that's barely more than a tunnel, through meditative pines and poor-postured Lombardy poplars. Once off the highway, the whole nighttime scene out here in Exurbia, Boston's true boonies, seems ghostly and circumspect. Hal's tires crunch cones in the road. Some sort of bird shits on his windshield. The driveway broadens gradually into a like delta, and then a parking lot of mint white gravel, and the physical QRS is right there, tubular and brooding. The building's one of these late-model, undeformed cubes of rough panel brick and granite coins. Illuminated, moodily, from below, by more classy lanterns, it looks like a building block from some child titan's toy chest. Its windows are the smoky brown kind that in daylight become dark mirrors. Hal's late father had publicly repudiated this kind of window glass in an interview in Lens and Pain when the stuff first came out. Right now, lit from inside, the windows have a sort of bloody, polluted aspect. A good two-thirds of the lot's parking places say reserved for staff, which strikes Hal as odd. The tow truck tends to diesel and chuff after de-ignition, finally subsiding with a shuddering fart. It's dead quiet except for the hiss of light traffic down on 27 past all the trees. Only TP-Link workers and marathon-type commuters live in exurban Natick. It's either way colder out here or else a front's been coming in while Hal drove. The lot's piney air has the ethyl sting of winter. QRS's big doors and lintel are more of that reflector-shade glass. There's no obvious bell, but the doors are unlocked. They open in that sort of pressurized way of institutional doors, The savanna-colored lobby is broad and still and has a vague medical-slash-dental smell. Its carpet's a dense, low, tan, dacrinile weave that evacuates sound. There's a circular, high-countered nurse's station or reception desk, but nobody's there. The whole place is so quiet, Hal can hear the squeak of blood in his head. The 32A that follows QRS in the girl's little white booklet is presumably a room number. Hal has on a non-ETA jacket and carries the NASA glass he spits in. He'd have to spit, even if he didn't have chew in. The Kodiak's almost like a cover or excuse. There is no map or "you are here" type directory on view in the lobby. The lobby's heat is intense and close, but kind of porous. It's in a sort of uneasy struggle with the radiant chill of all the smoked glass of the entrance. The lamps out in the lot and off along the driveway are blobs of sepia light through the glass. Inside, cove lighting at the seams of walls and ceiling produce an indirect light that's shadowless and seems to rise from the room's objects themselves. It's the same lighting and lion-colored carpeting in the first long hall Hal tries. The room numbers go up to 17, and then, after Hal turns a sharp corner, start at 34A. The room doors are false blonde wood, but look thick and private, flush in their frames. There's also the smell of stale coffee. The wall's color scheme is somewhere between puce and mature eggplant skin, kind of nauseous against the sandy tan of the carpet. All buildings with any kind of health theme to them have this thin, sick, sweet, dental subodor to them. QRS also seems to have some sort of balsamy air freshener going in the ventilation system, too, but it doesn't quite cover the sweet medical stink or the bland, sour smell of institutional food. Hal hasn't heard one human sound since he came in. The place's silence has that glittery sound of total silence. His footfalls make no sound on the dacrinile. He feels furtive and burglarish, and holds the NASA glass down at his side and the NA booklet higher up and cover out as a sort of explanatory ID. There are computer-enhanced landscapes on the walls, little low tables with glossy pamphlets, a framed print of Picasso's Seated Harlequin, and nothing else that wasn't just institutional bullshit. Visual muzak. Without any sound to his footfalls, it's like the gauntlets of doors just glide by. The quiet has a kind of menace. The whole cubular building seems to Hal to hold the tensed menace of a living thing that's chosen to hold itself still. If you asked Hal to describe his feelings as he looked for room 32A, the best he could do would be to say he wished he were somewhere else, and feeling some way besides how he felt. His mouth pours spit. The glass is one-third full and heavy in his hand, and not much fun to look at. He's missed the glass a couple of times and marred the tan carpet with dark spit. After 2 90-degree turns, it's clear the hallway's run is a perfect square around the cube's ground level. He's seen no stairs or entrances to stairways. He empties the NASA glass rather gooily into a potted rubber tree's dirt. QRS's building may be one of those infamous rubicular cubes that looks topologically undeformed but is actually impossible to negotiate on the inside. But the numbers after the third corner start at 18, and now Hal can hear either very distant or very muffled voices. He carries the NA booklet in front of him like a crucifix. He has about $50 U.S. and another $100 in eagle, leaf, and broom-emblemized ONA inscript, having had no idea what sort of introductory costs might be involved. QRS didn't purchase prime Natick acreage, and the cutting-edge services of a Sao Paulo school geometric minimalist architect with just altruistic goodwill, that was for sure. Room 32A's wooden grain door was just as emphatically shut as all the others, but the muffled voices were behind this one. The meeting was listed in the book as starting at 17:30, and it was only around 17:20, and Hal thought the voices might signify some sort of pre-meeting orientation for people who've come for the first time, sort of tentatively, just to scout the whole enterprise out, so he doesn't knock. He still has this intractable habit of making a move like he's straightening a bow tie before he enters a strange room. And except for the thin rubber sheaths, the doorknobs on the Quabbin Recovery System's doors are the same as at ETA. Flat bars of brass toggle bolted to the latch mechanism, so you have to push the bar down instead of turning anything to open the door. But the meeting is underway, apparently. It isn't near big enough to create a mood of anonymity or casual expectation. 9 or 10 adult middle-class males are in the warm room on orange plastic chairs with legs of molded steel tubing. Every one of the men has a beard, and each wears chinos and a sweater, and they all sit the same way, that Indian cross-legged style with their hands on their knees and their feet under their knees, and they all wear socks with no footwear or winter jackets anywhere in sight. Hal eases the door shut and sort of slinks along the wall to an empty chair, all the time conspicuously brandishing the meeting booklet. The chairs are placed in no discernible order, and their orange clashes nastily with the room's own colors, walls and ceiling, the color of Thousand Island dressing. A color scheme with unplaceable but uneasy associations for Hal, and more of the lion-skin Dacronal carpet. And the warm air in 32A is stuffy with CO2, and unpleasantly scented with the aroma of soft male middle-aged bodies not wearing footwear. A stale, meaty, cheesy smell. More nauseous even than the ETA locker room after a Mrs. Clark Tex-Mex fiesta. The only guy in the meeting to acknowledge Hal's entrance is at the front of the room, a man Hal would have to call almost morbidly round. His body nearly Leith-sized and globularly round, and a smaller but still large globe of a head atop it. His socks plaid, and his legs not all the way crossable, so it looks like he might pitch disastrously backward in his chair any minute, smiling warmly at Hal's winter coat and NASA glass, as Hal slinks and sits and slumps down low. The round man's chair is positioned under a small white magic marker blackboard, and all the other chairs approximately face it. And the man holds a magic marker in one hand and holds what looks quite a bit like a teddy bear to his chest with the other, and wears chinos and a cable-knit Norwegian sweater the color of toast. His hair is that waxy sort of blonde, and he's got the blonde eyebrows and creepy blonde eyelashes and violently flushed face of a true Norwegian blonde. And his little beard is an imperial, so sharply waxed it looks like a truncated star. The morbidly round, blonde man's pretty clearly the leader of the meeting, possibly a high-ranking official of Narcotics Anonymous, whom Hal could casually approach about tracts and texts to buy and study afterward. Another middle-aged guy up near the front is crying, and he, too, holds what looks like a bear. The blonde brows hike up and down as the leader says, "I'd like to suggest we men all hold our bears tight and let our inner infant non-judgmentally listen to Kevin's inner infant expressing his grief and loss." They're all at subtly different angles to Hal, who slumped low over by the wall in the second-to-last row. But it turns out, after some subtle casual neck craning, that, sure enough, all these middle-class guys, in at least their 30s, are sitting there clutching teddy bears to their sweatered chests. And identical teddy bears, plump and brown and splay-limbed and with a little red corduroy tongue protruding from the mouths, so the bears all look oddly throttled. The room is menacingly quiet now except for the sibilance of the heating vents and the sobbing guy Kevin and the plip of Hal's saliva hitting the bottom of the empty glass rather more loudly than he might have wished. The back of the crying guy's neck is turning redder and redder as he clutches his bear and rocks on his hams. Hal sits with his leg crossed, good ankle on knee, and joggles his white high top and looks at his calloused thumb and listens to the Kevin guy sob and snuffle. The guy wipes his nose with the heel of his hand, just like the littler buddies at ETA. Hal figures the tears and bears have something to do with giving up drugs, and that the meeting is probably on the verge of coming around to talking explicitly about drugs and how to give up drugs for a certain period without feeling indescribably wretched and bereft. or maybe at least some data on how long one might expect the wretchedness of giving up drugs to continue before the old nervous system and salivary glands return to normal. Even though inner infant sounds uncomfortably close to Dr. Dolores Rusk's dreaded inner child, Harold be willing to bet that here it's some sort of shorthand, Narcotics Anonymous sobriquet for, like, limbic component of the CNS, or the part of our cortex that's not utterly wretched and bereft without the drugs that up to now have been pulling us through the day, secretly, or some affirming, encouraging thing like that. Hal wills himself to stay objective and not form any judgments before he has serious data, hoping desperately for some sort of hopeful feeling to emerge. The diglobular leader has made a cage of his hands and rested his hands on his teddy bear's head and is breathing slowly and evenly, watching Kevin kindly from under the blonde eyebrows, looking more than anything like some sort of Buddha-esque California surfer dude. The leader inhales gently and says, "The energies I'm feeling in the group are energies of unconditional love and acceptance for Kevin's inner infant." Nobody else says anything, and the leader doesn't seem to need anybody to say anything. He looks down at the cage his hands have made on the bear, and keeps subtly changing the shape of the cage. The guy Kevin, whose neck is now not only beet red but shiny with embarrassed sweat between his shirt collar and hair's hem, sobs even harder at the affirmation of love and support. The round leader's high, hoarse voice had the same blandly kind, didactic quality as Rusk's, as if always speaking to a not-too-bright child. After some more cage play and deep breathing, the leader looks up and around and nods at nothing and says, "Maybe we could all name our feelings right now for Kevin and share how much we're caring for him and his inner infant right now, in his pain." Various bearded, cross-legged guys speak up.
"I love you, Kevin."
"I'm not judging you, Kevin."
"No, just how you and the I feel."
"I'm feeling really close to you."
"I'm feeling a lot of love for you right now, Kevin."
"You're crying for two, guy."
"Kevin, Kevin, 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 Kevin."
"I'm not feeling like your crying is one bit unmanly or pathetic, fella."
It's at this point that Hal begins truly to lose his willed objectivity and open-mindedness, and to get a bad personal feeling about this Narcotics Anonymous NA meeting, which seems already deeply underway and isn't one bit like he's imagined an even remotely hopeful anti-drug meeting would be like. It seems more like some kind of cosmetic psychology encounter thing. Now, one substance or symptom of substance deprivation has been mentioned so far. And none of these guys looks like they've ever been engaged with anything more substantial than an occasional wine cooler, if he had to guess. Hal's grim mood deepens as the round man up front now leans precariously over and down and opens a sort of toy box under the blackboard by his chair and produces a cheap plastic portable CD laser scanner and sets it on top of the toy box, where it begins to issue a kind of low, treacly, ambient shopping mall music, mostly cello, with sporadic harps and chimes. The stuff spreads through the hot little room like melted butter, and Hal sinks lower in his orange chair and looks hard at the space and spacecraft emblem on his NASA glass.
"Kevin,"
the leader says over the music.
"Kevin."
The sobbing man's hand lies over his face like a spider, and he doesn't even start to look up until the leader has said several times very blandly and kindly,
"Kevin, do you feel okay about looking at the rest of the group?"
Kevin's red neck wrinkles as he looks up at the blonde leader through his fingers. The leader's made the cage again on his poor bear's squashed head.
"Can you share what you're feeling, Kevin?"
he says.
"Can you name it?"
Kevin's voice is muffled by the hand he hides behind.
"I'm feeling my inner infant's abandonment and deep deprivation issues, Harf,"
he says, drawing shuddering breaths. His mauve sweater's shoulders tremble.
I'm feeling my inner infant standing, holding the bars of his crib and looking out of the bars. Bars of his crib and crying for his mommy and daddy to come hold him and nurture him.
Kevin sobs twice in an apneated way. One arm holds his laps bare so tight Hal thinks he can see a little stuffing start to come out of its mouth around its tongue. And a stalactite of that clear, thin, weepy-type mucus hangs from Kevin's nose just millimeters over the throttled bear's head.
And nobody's coming,
he sobs.
Nobody's coming. I feel alone with my bear and plastic airplane bubble and teething ring.
Everybody's nodding in an affirming and pained way. No two beards are exactly the same fullness and design. A couple other sobs break out across the room. Everyone's bear stares blankly ahead. The leader's nod is slow and meditative.
And can you share your needs with the group right now, Kevin?
Please share, Kevin, says a slim guy over by a black filing cabinet who sits like he's a veteran at sitting Indian style in hard plastic chairs. The music's still going absolutely nowhere, like Philip Glass on Quaaludes.
The work we're here to do, the leader says over the music,
one hand now pressed pensively to the side of his big face,
is to work on our dysfunctional passivity and tendency to wait silently for our inner infant's needs to be magically met. The energy I feel in the group now is that the group is supportively asking Kevin to nurture his inner infant by naming and sharing his needs out loud with the group. And I'm feeling how aware we all are, how risky and vulnerable need naming out loud must feel for Kevin right now.
Everybody looks deadly serious. A couple guys are rubbing their bear's bellies pregnantly. The only really infantile thing Hal can feel inside him is the inguinal gurgle of two heavy bran muffins swallowed at high speeds without liquid. The string of mucus from Kevin's nose trembles and swings. The slender guy who'd asked Kevin, please, to share, is now waggling the arms of his teddy bear in an infantile way. Hal feels a wave of nausea flood his mouth with fresh saliva.
We're asking you to name what your inner infant wants right now more than anything in the world,
the leader's saying to Kevin.
To be loved and held.
Kevin keens, sobbing harder. His lacrimucus is now a thin silver string joining his nose and the fuzzy top of his bear's head. The bear's expression is seeming creepier to Hal by the second. Hal wonders what the etiquette is in N.A. about getting up and leading right in the middle of somebody's infantile revelation of need. Meanwhile, Kevin is saying that his inner infant inside him had always hoped that someday his mom and dad would be there for him, to hold him, and love him. He says, but right from the start, they'd never been there for him, leaving him and his brother with Hispanic nannies while they devoted themselves to their jobs and various types of psychotherapy and support groups. This takes a while to say, given all the snuffles and racked spasms. Then Kevin says, but then by the time he was 8, they were gone altogether, dead, smooshed, by a dysfunctionally falling radio traffic helicopter on the Jamaica Way, on the way to couples counseling. At this, Hal's slumped head jerks up, his mouth oval with horror. He's all of a sudden realized that this guy who's seated at such an angle that Hal's been able to see only the obliquest portion of his profile is in fact Kevin Bain, his brother Oren's old ETA doubles and chemical mischief partner, Marlon Bain's older brother, Kevin Bain, of Dedham, Massachusetts, who, the last Hal had heard, had gotten his MBA at Wharton and cleaned up with a string of simulated reality arcades all up and down the South Shore, back during the pre-subsidized time simulated reality craze, before interlace viewers and digital cartridges let you do your own customized simulating right at home and the novelty wore off.
335.
The Kevin Bain whose childhood hobby was memorizing IRS capital depreciation schedules, and whose adult idea of a wild time,
336,
had been putting extra marshmallows in his nightly cocoa, and who wouldn't have known a recreational drug if it walked up and poked him in the eye. Hal begins to scan for possible exits. The only door was the one he'd come in, which is in full view of most of the room. There are no windows at all. Hal's chilled by multiple realizations. This is no NA, or anti-substance meeting. This is one of those men's issues, men's movement type meetings Katie Coyle's stepdad went to, and Coyle liked to mimic and parody during drills, making his stick's grip poke out between his legs and yelling, "Nurture this! Honor getting in touch with this!" Kevin Bain is wiping his nose with his poor teddy bear's head and saying it didn't look like his inner infant would ever get its wish. The gooey music's cello sounds like some sort of cow mooing in distress, maybe at what it's in the middle of. Sure enough, the round man, whose hands left a print on his soft cheek, asks poor old Kevin Bain to honor and name his eye's wounded wish anyway. To say, "Please, Mommy and Daddy, come love and hold me," out loud several times, which Kevin Bain goes ahead and does, rocking a little in his chair, his voice now with an edge of good old adult mortified embarrassment to it, along with the racking sobs. A couple of the other men in the room are wiping at their bright white drug-free eyes with the arms of their teddy bears. Hal is painfully reminded of the rare Ziplocs of Humboldt County hydroponic marijuana that Pemulus occasionally scored via FedEx from his mercantile counterpart at the Rolling Hills Academy. The curved tawny buds so big and plump with high Delta-9 resin, the Ziplocs had looked like bags of little teddy bear arms. The moist sounds right behind him turn out to be a mild-faced older man eating yogurt out of a plastic cup. Hal keeps rechecking the meeting data in the little MBRO booklet the girl had given him. He notes that the booklet has broad chocolate thumbprints on several of the pages, and that two pages are stuck firmly together with what Hal fears is an ancient dried booger. And now that the booklet's cover is dated January in the year of dairy products from the American heartland, that is nearly 2 years past, and that it's not impossible that the blandly, hostile, toothless girl at the Ennett facility had kertwanged him by giving him a dated and useless MBRO guide. Kevin Bain keeps repeating, "Please, Mommy and Daddy, come love me and hold me," in a kind of monotone of pathos. The gradually intensifying lisp in "please" is apparently a performative invocation of the old inner infant. Tears and other fluids flow and roll. The warm, round leader Harv's own eyes are a moist, glassy blue. The CD scanner's cello is now into some sort of semi-jazzy pizzicato stuff that seems oxymoronic against the room's mood. Hal keeps catching whiffs of a hot, sick, sweet, civety smell that signifies somebody nearby has some athlete's foot issues to confront under his socks. Plus, it's mystifying that 32A has no windows, given all the smoky brown fenestration Hal'd seen from outside the QRS cube. The man eating yogurt's beard is one of those small rectangular ones that's easy to keep clear of the cup's rim. The back and side of Kevin Bain's hair is separated into spocky, sweat-soaked strands from the room's heat and the infant's emotions. All through his own infancy and toddlerhood, Hal had continually been held and dandled and told at high volume that he was loved, and he feels like he could have told Kay Bain's inner infant that getting held and told you were loved didn't automatically seem like it rendered you emotionally whole or substance-free. Hal finds he rather envies a man who feels he has something to explain his being fucked up. Parents to blame it on. Not even Pemulus blamed his late father, Mr. Pemulus, who hadn't exactly sounded like the Fred McMurray of U.S. fathers. But then Pemulus didn't consider himself fucked up or unfree with regards to substances. The blonde and Buddhic cable-knit Harv, dandling his bear on his knee now, calmly asks Kevin Bain if it feels to his inner infant like Mommy and Daddy were ever going to appear cribside to meet his needs.
"No,
Kevin says very quietly.
No, it doesn't, Harv.
The leader is idly arranging his bear's splayed arms in different positions, so it looks like the bear is either waving or surrendering.
Do you suppose you would be able to ask someone in the group here tonight to love and hold you instead, Kevin?
The back of Kevin Bain's head doesn't move. Hal's whole digestive tract spasms at the prospect of watching two bearded adult males in sweaters and socks engage in surrogate infant hugging. He begins asking himself why he doesn't just fake a hideous coughing fit and flee QRS-32A with his fist over his face. Harv's now waggling the bear's arms back and forth and making his voice high and cartoon characterish, and pretending to have his bear ask Kevin Bain's bear if it would maybe point to the man in the group Kevin Bain would most like to have hold and nurture and love him in loco parentis. Hal's spitting quietly down the side of his glass and brooding wretchedly at the fact that he's driven 50 supperless clicks to listen to a globular man in plaid socks pretend his teddy bear is speaking Latin when he looks up from the glass and is chilled to see that Kevin Bain has wiggled his Indian-style way around in his chair and is holding his bear way up by its underarms, just the way a father holds a toddler up for a public spect-op or parade, turning the throttled-looking bear this way and that, scanning the room, as Hal covers part of his face with a hand, pretending to scratch an eyebrow, praying not to be recognized, and finally manipulating the bear's arm so the plump, brown, fuzzy, fingerless hand of the bear's pointing right in Hal's direction. Hal doubles over in a coughing spasm, only half-faked, running decision trees on various ruses for flight. Just like his younger brother Marlon Bain, Kevin Bain is a short, thick person with a dark, swart face. He looks sort of like an overdeveloped troll, and he has the same capacity for constant, incredible sweating that always made Marlon Bain look to Hal, both on court and off, like a toad, hunched moist and unblinking in humid shade. Except Kevin Bain's little glittery Bain eyes are also red and swollen with public weeping, and he's balding back from the temples in a way that gives him a widow's peak like nobody's business, and doesn't seem to recognize a post-pubescent Hal, and is pointing his bear's blunt hand, Hal realizes finally, after almost swallowing his plug of Kodiak, not at Hal, but at the mild-faced, square-bearded older guy behind him, who's holding a spoon of vividly pink yogurt in front of his bear's open mouth, just touching its protruding tongue's red corduroy, pretending to be feeding the bear. Hal, very casually, puts the NASA glass between his legs and gets both hands under his chair seat and hops the chair bit by bit over and out of the lines of sight and transit between Kevin Bain and the yogurt man. Harv, up front, is making a complex hand signal to the yogurt man not to speak or move from his back row orange chair no matter what. And then, as Kevin Bain wriggles cross-legged back around to face front again, Harv smoothly turns the hand signal into a motion like he's smoothing his hair. The motion then becomes sincere and ruminative as the leader breathes deeply a couple of times. The music settled back into its original nodding narcosis.
Kevin, Harv says, since this is a group exercise in passivity and inner infant needs, and since you've selected Jim as the member of the group you need something from, we need you to ask Jim out loud to meet your needs. Ask him to come up and hold you and love you since your parents aren't ever coming. Not ever, Kevin.
Kevin Bain makes a mortified sound and reclamps a hand over his big, swart face.
Go for it, Kev,
somebody over near the blind poster calls out.
We affirm and support you,
says the guy by the filing cabinet. Hal now starts scrolling through an alphabetical list of the faraway places he'd rather be right now. He's not even up to Addis Ababa when Kevin Bain acquiesces and begins very softly and hesitantly asking the mild-faced Jim, who's put aside his yogurt but not the bear, to please come up and love him and hold him. By the time Hal's envisioned himself tumbling over American Falls at the concavity's southwest rim in a rusty old noxious waste displacement drum, Kevin Bain has asked Jim 11 progressively louder times to come nurture and hold him, to no avail. The older guy just sits there, clutching his yogurt-tongued bear, his expression somewhere between mild and blank. Hal has never actually seen projectile weeping before. Bane's tears are actually exiting his eyes and projecting outward several centimeters before starting to fall. His facial expression is the scrunched spread one of a small child's total woe, his neck cord standing out and face darkening so that it looks like some sort of huge catcher's mitt. A bright cape of mucus hangs from his upper lip, and his lower lip seems to be having some kind of epileptic fit. Hal finds the tantrum's expression on an adult face sort of compelling. At a certain point, hysterical grief becomes facially indistinguishable from hysterical mirth, it appears. Hal imagines watching Bane weep on a white beach through binoculars from the balcony of a cool, dim, Aruban hotel room.
"He's not coming!"
Kevin Bain finally keens to the leader. Harv, the leader, nods, scratching an eyebrow, and confirms that that seems to be the case. He pretends to stroke his imperial in puzzlement and asks, rhetorically, what might be the problem, why mild-faced Jim isn't automatically coming when called. Kevin Bain's just about vivisecting his poor bear out of mortified frustration. He seems deeply into his infant persona now, and Hal rather hopes these guys have procedures for getting Bane at least back to 16 before he has to try to drive home. At some point, a timpani has gotten involved in the CD's music, and a rather saucy cornet, and the music's finally started moving a little toward what's either a climax or the end of the disc. By now, various men in the group have started crying out to Kevin Bain that his inner infant wasn't getting its needs met, that sitting there passively asking for nurture to get up and come to him wasn't getting the needs met, that Kevin owed it to his inner infant to come up with some sort of active way to meet the infant's needs. Somebody shouted out, "Honor that infant!" Somebody else called, "Meet those needs!" Hal is mentally strolling down the Appian Way in bright Euro sunlight, eating a cannoli, twirling his Dunlop rackets by the throats like six-shooters, enjoying the sunshine and cranial silence and a normal salivary flow. Pretty soon the men's supportive exhortations have distilled into everybody in the room except Harv, Jim, and Hal, chanting, "Meet those needs! Meet those needs!" in the same male crowd exhortive meter as, "Hold that line!" or, "Block that kick!" Kevin Bain wipes his nose on his sleeve and asks humongous Harv, the leader, what he's supposed to do to get his infant's needs met if the person he's chosen to meet those needs won't come. The leader has folded his hands over his belly and sat back by this time, smiling, cross-legged, holding his tongue. His bear sits atop the protrusion of belly with its little blunt legs straight out, the way you'll see a bear sitting on a shelf. It seems to Hal that the O2 in 32A is now getting used up at a ferocious clip. Not at all like the cool, sheep-scented breezes of Ascension Island in the South Atlantic. The men in the room are still chanting, "Meet those needs!"
"What you're saying is, I need to actively go over to Jim myself and ask him to hold me,"
Kevin Bain says, grinding at his eyes with his knuckles. The leader smiles blandly.
"Instead of you saying passively trying to get Jim to come to me,"
says Kevin Bain, whose tears have largely stopped, and whose sweat has taken on the clammy shine of true fear sweat. Harv emerges as one of these people who can heft one eyebrow and not the other.
"It would take real courage and love and commitment to your inner infant to take the risk and go actively over to somebody that might give you what your infant needs," he says quietly.
The CD player has at some point shifted into an all-cello instrumental of "I Don't Know How to Love Him" from an old opera Lyle sometimes borrowed people's players and listened to at night in the weight room. Lyle and Marlon Bain had been particularly tight, Hal recalls. The trimeter of the man's chant has reduced to a one-foot low volume needs, 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 as Kevin Bain slowly and hesitantly uncrosses his legs and rises from his orange chair, turning to face Hal and the motionless guy behind him, this Jim. Bain begins to move slowly toward them with the tortured steps of a mime, miming, walking against a tornadic gale. Hal's picturing himself doing a lazy backstroke in the Azores, spouting glassy water up out of his mouth in a cytological plume. He's leaning almost out of his chair, as far as possible out of Kevin Bain's line of transit, studying the brown suspension in the bottom of his glass. His prayer, not to be recognized by a regressive Kevin Bain, is the first really desperate and sincere prayer Hal can remember offering since he'd stopped wearing pajamas with feet in them.
"Kevin," Harf calls softly from the front of the room, "is it you moving actively toward Jim? Or should it be the infant inside you? The one with the needs?"
"Needs, needs, needs," the bearded men are chanting, some rhythmically raising their manicured fists in the air. Bane's looking back and forth between Harv and Jim, chewing his finger indecisively.
"Is this how an infant moves towards its needs, Kevin?"
Harv says.
"Go for it, Kevin!" a full-bearded man calls out. "Let the infant out! Let your infant do the walking, Kev!"
So Hal's most vivid full-color memory of the non-anti-substance meeting he drove 50 over-salivated clicks to by mistake will become that of his older brother's doubles partner's older brother down on all fours on a dacronyl rug, crawling, hampered because one arm was holding his bear to his chest, so he sort of dipped and rose as he crawled on three limbs toward Hal and the needs meter behind him. Bane's knees leaving twin pale tracks in the carpet, and his head up on a wobbly neck, and looking up and past Hal. His face, unspeakable. The ceiling was breathing. It bulged and receded. It swelled and settled. The room was in St. Elizabeth's Hospital's trauma wing. Whenever he looked at it, the ceiling bulged and then deflated, shiny as a lung. When Don was a massive toddler, his mother had put them in a little beach house, just back of the dunes off a public beach in Beverly. The place was affordable because it had a big ragged hole in the roof. Origin of hole, unknown. Gately's outsized crib had been in the beach house's little living room, right under the hole. The guy that owned the little cottages off the dunes had stapled thick, clear polyurethane sheeting across the room's ceiling. It was an attempt to deal with the hole. The polyurethane bulged and settled in the North Shore wind and seemed like some monstrous vacuole, inhaling and exhaling directly over little Gately, lying there, wide-eyed. The breathing polyurethane vacuole had seemed like it developed a character and personality as winter deepened and the winds grew worse. Gately, aged like 4, had regarded the vacuole as a living thing, and had named it Herman, and had been afraid of it. He couldn't feel the right side of his upper body. He couldn't move in any real sense of the word. The hospital room had that misty quality rooms and fevers have. Gately lay on his back. Ghostish figures materialized at the peripheries of his vision and hung around and then dematerialized. The ceiling bulged and receded. Gailey's own breath hurt his throat. His throat felt somehow raped. The blurred figure in the next bed sat up very still in bed in a sitting position and seemed to have a box on its head. Gately kept having a terrible repetitious ethnocentric dream that he was robbing the house of an Oriental, and had the guy tied to a chair and was trying to blindfold him with quality mailing twine from the drawer under the Oriental's kitchen phone. The Oriental kept being able to see around the twine and kept looking steadily at Gately and blinking inscrutably. Plus, the Oriental had no nose or mouth, just a smooth expanse of lower facial skin, and wore a silk robe and scary sandals and had no hair on its legs. What Gately perceived as light cycles and events all out of normal sequence was really Gately going in and out of consciousness. Gately did not perceive this. It seemed to him more like he kept coming up for air and then being pushed below the surface of something. Once, when Gately came up for air, he found that resident Tiny Yule was seated in a chair right up next to the bed. Tiny's little slim hand was on the bed's crib-type railing, and his chin rested on the hand, so his face was right up close. The ceiling bulged and receded. The room's only light was what spilled in from the nighttime hall. Nurses glided down the hall and past the door in subsonic footwear. A tall and slumped, ghostish figure appeared to Gately's left, off past the blurred, seated square-head boy's bed, slumped and fluttering, appearing to rest its tailbone on the sill of the dark window. The ceiling rounded on down and then settled back flat. Gately rolled his eyes up at Yule. Yule had shaved off his blunt white goatee. His hair was so completely clean and white, it took a faint pink cast from the pink of his scalp below. Yule had been discoursing to him for an unknown length of time. It was Gately's first full night in St. Elizabeth's Hospital's trauma wing. He didn't know what night of the week it was. His circadian rhythm was the least of the personal rhythms that had been scrambled. His right side felt encased in a kind of hot cement. Also a sick throb in what he assumed was a toe. He wondered, dimly, about going to the bathroom, if and when. Yule was right in the middle of speaking. Gately couldn't tell if Yule was whispering. Nurses glided across the doorway's light. Their sneakers were so noiseless the nurses seemed to be on wheels. A stolid shadow of somebody in a hat was cast obliquely across the hall's tile floor just outside the room, as if a stolid figure were seated just outside the door, against the wall, in a hat. "My wife's personal term for soul is personality, as in, there's something incorrigibly dark in your personality, Eldred Yule, and Dewars brings it out." The hall floor was pretty definitely white tile, with a cloudy, overwaxed shine and the bright fluorescence out there. Some kind of red or pink stripe ran down the center of the hall. Gately couldn't tell if Tiny Yule thought he was awake, or unconscious, or what. "It was in the fall term of third grade as a child that I found myself falling in with the bad element. They were a group of tough, blue-collar Irish lads bussed in from the East Watertown projects. Runny noses, home-cut hair, frayed cuffs, quick with their fists. Sports mad, fond of sneaker hockey on asphalt," Ewell said. "And yet, strangely, I, unable to do even one pull-up in the president's physical fitness test, quickly became the leader of the pack we all fell into. The blue-collar lads all seemed to admire me for attributes that were not clear. We formed a sort of club. Our uniform was a gray scally cap. Our clubhouse was the dugout of a Little League diamond that had fallen into disuse. Our club was called the Money Stealers Club. At my suggestion, we went with a descriptive name as opposed to euphemistic. The name was mine. The Irish lads acquiesced. They viewed me as the brains of the operation. I held them in a kind of thrall. This was due in large part to my capacity for rhetoric. Even the toughest and most brutish Irish lad respects a gilded tongue. Our club was formed for the express purpose of undertaking a bunco operation. We went around to people's homes after school, ringing the doorbell and soliciting donations for Project Hope Youth Hockey. There was no such organization. Our donation receptacle was a chock-full-of-nuts can with Project Hope Youth Hockey written on a strip of masking tape wrapped around the can. The lad who made the receptacle had spelled Project with a G in the first draft. I ridiculed him for the error, and the whole club pointed at him and laughed. Brutally. Yule kept staring at the crude blue jailhouse square and canted cross on Gately's forearms. Our only visible credentials were knee pads and sticks we purloined from the P.E. stockroom. By my order, all were held carefully to conceal the P.P.T.Y.W.W.T.T.N.E.L.E.M.S.C.H. emblazoned down the side of every stick.
One lad had a goalie mask on under his scally cap, the rest knee pads and carefully held sticks. The knee pads were turned inside out for the same reason. I couldn't even skate. My mother absolutely forbade rough play on asphalt. I wore a necktie and combed my hair carefully after each solicitation. I was the spokesperson. The mouthpiece, the bad lads called me. They were Irish Catholics all. What a town from east to west is Catholic, Armenian, and mixed. The east side boys all but genuflected to my gift for bullshit. I was exceptionally smooth with adults. I rang doorbells and the lads arrayed themselves behind me on the porch. I spoke of disadvantaged youth and team spirit and fresh air and the meaning of competition and alternatives to the after-school street's bad element. I spoke of mothers in support hose and war-injured older brothers with elaborate prostheses, cheering disadvantaged lads on to victory against far better equipped teams. I discovered that I had a gift for it, the emotional appeal of adult rhetoric. It was the first time I felt personal power. I was unrehearsed and creative and moving. Hard-case homeowners who came to the door in sleeveless tees, holding tall boys of beer with stubble and expressions of minimal charity, were often weeping openly by the time we left their porch. I was called a fine lad, and a good kid, and a credit to me mom and da. My hair was tousled so often I had to carry a mirror and comb. The coffee can became hard to carry back to the dugout, where we hid it behind a cinder block bench support. We'd netted over $100 by Halloween. This was a serious amount in those days. Tiny Yule and the ceiling kept receding and then looming in, bulging roundly. Figures Gately didn't know from Adam kept popping in and out of fluttery view in different corners of the room. The space between his bed and the other bed seemed to distend and then contract with a slow sort of boinging motion. Gately's eyes kept rolling up in his head, his upper lip mustached with sweat. And I was reveling in the fraud of it, the discovery of the gift, Ewell was saying. I was flushed with adrenaline. I had tasted power, the verbal manipulation of human hearts. The lads called me the Gilded Blarney Man. Soon the first order fraud wasn't enough. I began secretly filching receipts from the club's chock-full-of-nuts can. Embezzling. I persuaded the lads it was too risky to keep the can in the open-air dugout and took personal charge of the can. I kept the can in my bedroom and persuaded my mother that it contained Christmas-connected gifts and must under no circumstances be inspected. To my underlings in the club, I claimed to be rolling the coins and depositing them in a high-interest savings account I'd opened for us in the name Franklin W. Dixon. In fact, I was buying myself Pez and Milky Ways and Mad Magazines and a Creeple People brand deluxe oven and mold set with 6 different colors of goo. This was in the early 1970s. At first I was discreet. Grandiose, but discreet. At first the embezzlement was controlled. But the power had roused something dark in my personality, and the adrenaline drove it forward. Self-will run riot. Soon the club's coffee can was empty by each weekend's end. Each week's haul went towards some uncontrolled Saturday binge of puerile consumption. I doctored up flamboyant bank statements to show the club in the dugout. I got more loquacious and imperious with them. None of the lads thought to question me, or the purple magic marker the bank statements were done in. I was not dealing with intellectual titans here, I knew. They were nothing but malice and muscle, the worst of the school's bad element. And I ruled them. Thrall. They trusted me completely, and the rhetorical gift. In retrospect, they probably couldn't conceive of any sane third grader with glasses and a necktie trying to defraud them, given the inevitably brutal consequences. Any sane third grader. But I was no longer a sane third grader. I lived only to feed the dark thing in my personality, which told me any consequences could be forestalled by my gift and grand personal aura. But then, of course, eventually, Christmas hove into view. Gately tries to stop Yule and say, "Hove?" and finds to his horror that he can't make any sounds come out. The meaty Catholic East Side bad element lads now wanted to tap their non-existent Franklin W. Dixon account to buy support hose and sleeveless tees for their swarthy blue-collar families. I held them off as long as I could with pedantic blather on interest penalties and fiscal years. Irish Catholic Christmas is no laughing matter, though, and for the first time their swarthy eyes began to narrow at me. Things at school grew increasingly tense. One afternoon, the largest and swarthiest of them assumed control of the can in an ugly dugout coup. It was a blow from which my authority never recovered. I began to feel a gnawing fear. My denial broke. I realized I'd gradually embezzled far more than I could ever make good. At home, I began talking up the merits of private school curricula at the dinner table. The can's weekly take fell off sharply as holiday expenses drained homeowners of change and patience. This bear market in giving was attributed by some of the club's swarthier lads to my deficiencies. The whole club began muttering in the dugout. I began to learn that one could perspire heavily even in a bitterly cold open-air dugout. Then on the first day of Advent, the lad now in charge of the can produced childish-looking figures and announced the whole club wanted their share of the accrued booty in the Dixon account. I bought time with vague allusions to co-signatures and a misplaced passbook. I arrived home with chattering teeth and bloodless lips and was forced by my mother to swallow fish oil. I was consumed with puerile fear. I felt small and weak and evil, and consumed by dread of my embezzlement's exposure. Not to mention the brutal consequences. I claimed intestinal distress and stayed home from school. The telephone began ringing in the middle of the night. I could hear my father saying, "Hello, hello." I did not sleep. My personality's dog pot had grown leathery wings and a beak and turned on me. There were still several days until Christmas vacation. I'd lie in bed panicked during school hours amid piles of ill-gotten mad magazines and creeple people figures, and listen to the lonely handheld bells of the Salvation Army Santas on the street below, and think of synonyms for dread and doom. I began to know shame, and to know it as grandiosity's aide-de-camp. My unspecific digestive illness wore on, and teachers sent cards and concern notes. On some days the door buzzer would buzz after school hours, and my mother would come upstairs and say, "How sweet, Eldred." That there were swarthy and cuff-frayed but clearly good-hearted boys in gray scally caps on the stoop asking after me, and declaring that they were keenly awaiting my return to school. I began to gnaw on the bathroom soap in the morning to make a convincing case for staying home. My mother was alarmed at the masses of bubbles I vomited, and threatened to consult a specialist. I felt myself moving closer and closer to some cliff edge at which everything would come out. I longed to be able to lean into my mother's arms and weep and confess all. I could not, for the shame. Three or four of the Money Stealers Club's harder cases took up afternoon positions by the nativity scene in the churchyard across from our house and stared stonily up at my bedroom window, pounding their fists in their palms. I began to understand what a Belfast Protestant must feel, but even more prospectively dreadful than pummelings from Irish Catholics was the prospect of my parents finding out my personality at a dark thing that had driven me to grandiose wickedness and left me there. Gately has no idea how Ewell feels about him making no responses, whether Ewell doesn't like it, or even notices it, or what. He can breathe okay, but something in his raped throat won't let whatever's supposed to vibrate to speak vibrate. Finally, on the day before my gastroenterologist appointment, when my mother was down the street at a speculum party, I crept downstairs from my sick bed and stole over $100 from a shoebox marked IBEW Local 517 Petty Slush in the back of my father's dense closet. I'd never dreamed of resorting to the shoebox before. Stealing from my own parents? To remit funds I'd stolen from dull-witted boys, with whom I'd stolen them from adults I'd lied to? My feelings of fear and despicability only increased. I now felt ill for real. I lived and moved in the shadow of something dark that hovered just overhead. I vomited without aid of emetic now, but secretly, so I could return to school. I couldn't face the prospect of a whole Christmas vacation, a swarthy sentries pounding their palms outside the house. I converted my father's union's bills to small change and paid off the Money Stealers Club, and got pummeled anyway
apparently on general bad element principles. I discovered the latent rage in followers, the fate of the leader who falls from the mob's esteem. I was pummeled and given a savage wedgie, and hung from a hook in my school locker, where I remained for several hours, swollen and mortified. And going home was worse. Home was no refuge. For home was the scene of the third-order crime, of theft cubed. I couldn't sleep. I tossed and turned. There were night terrors. I was unable to eat, no matter how long after supper I had to stay at the table. The more worried about me my parents became, the greater my shame. I felt a shame and personal despicability no third grader should have to feel. The holidays were not jolly. I looked back over the autumn and failed to recognize anyone named Eldred K. Ewell, Jr. It no longer seemed a question of insanity or dark parts of me. I had stolen from neighbors, slum children, and family, and bought myself sweets and toys. Under any tenable definition of bad, I was bad. I resolved to toe the virtuous line from then on. The shame and horror was too awful. I had to remake myself. I resolved to do whatever was required to see myself as good, remade. I never knowingly committed another felony. The whole shameful interval of the Money Stealers Club was moved to metal storage and buried there. Dawn, I'd forgotten it ever happened. Until the other night. Dawn, the other night, after the fracas and your display of reluctant se offendendo.
337.
After your injury and the whole aftermath? Dawn, I dreamed the whole mad, repressed third-grade interval of grandiose perfidy all over again. Vividly. And completely. When I awoke, I was somehow minus my goatee, and my hair was center-parted in a fashion I haven't favored for 40 years. The bed was soaked, and there was a gnawed-looking cake of McDade's special anti-acne soap in my hand. Gately starts to short-term recall that he was offered IV Demerol for the pain of his gunshot wound immediately on admission to the ER, and has been offered Demerol twice by shift doctors who haven't bothered to read the History of Narcotics Dependency, No Schedule C4 Plus Medic, that Gately'd made Pat Modisian swear she'd make them put in italics on his file or chart or whatever, first thing. Last night's emergency surgery was remedial, not extractive, because the big pistol's ordnance had apparently fragmented on impacting and passed through the meters of muscle that surrounded Gately's humerus ball and scapula socket, passing through and missing bone, but doing great and various damage to soft tissues. The ER's trauma specialist had prescribed Toradol IM, but had warned
338
that the pain after the surgery's general anesthetic wore off was going to be unlike anything Gately had ever imagined. The next thing Gately knew, he was upstairs in a trauma wing room that trembled with sunlight, and a different doctor was speculating to either Pat M. or Calvin T. that the invasive foreign body had been treated with something unclean, beforehand, possibly, because Gately's developed a massive infection, and they're monitoring him for something he heard as noxema, but is really toxemia. Gately also wanted to protest that his body was 100% American, but he seemed temporarily unable to vocalize aloud. Later it was nighttime, and Ewell was there, intoning. It was totally unclear what Ewell wanted from Gately, or why he was choosing this particular time to share. Gately's right shoulder was almost the same size as his head, and he had to roll his eyes up and over like a cow to see Ewell's hand on the railing and his face floating above it. And how will I administer the ninth step when it comes time to make amends? How can I start to make reparations? Even if I could remember the homes of the citizens we defrauded, how many could still be there living? The club lads have doubtless scattered into various low-rent districts and dead-end careers. My father lost the IBEW account under the Weld administration.
339.
And has been dead since 1993. And the revelations would kill my mother. My mother is very frail. She uses a walker, and arthritis has twisted her head nearly all the way around on her neck. My wife jealously protects my mother from all unpleasant facts regarding me. She says someone has to do it. My mother believes right this minute I'm at a 9-month Banque de Genève-sponsored tax law symposium in the Alsace. She keeps sending me knitted ski wear that doesn't fit from the rest home. Don, this buried interval and the impost I've carried ever since may have informed my whole life. Why I was drawn to tax law, helping wealthy suburbanites two-step around their fair share. My marriage to a woman who looks at me as if I were a dark stain at the back of a child's trousers. My whole descent into somewhat heavier than normal drinking may have been some instinctive attempt to bury third-grade feelings of despicability, submerge them in an amber sea. I don't know what to do, Ewell said. Gately was on enough toward all I am to make his ears ring, plus a saline drip with Dorix.
340.
I don't want to remember despicabilities I can do nothing about. If this is a sample of the more will be revealed, I hereby lodge a complaint. Some things seem better left submerged, no? And everything on his right side was on fire. The pain was getting to be emergency-type pain, like scream and yank your charred hand off the stove-type pain. Parts of him kept sending up emergency flares to other parts of him, and he could neither move nor call out. I'm scared. From what seemed somewhere overhead and rising was the last thing Gately heard Ewell whisper as the ceiling bulged down toward them. Gately wanted to tell Tiny Ewell that he could totally fucking ID with Ewell's feelings, and that if he, Tiny, could just hang in and tote that bale and put one little well-shined shoe in front of the other, everything would end up all right.